Before I knew it, 2 weeks had passed. I had 10 wins under my belt, and I was becoming a bit of a radio phenomenon. My voice had stopped trembling, and I wasn't just winning. I was pulverizing rappers with perfect wins, instances where every caller voted for the same contestant. The Baca Boys started advertising the roll call earlier in the day, replaying my appearances with the promise that LA's most talked about rapper would be competing later, which made me laugh while I was fetching coffee on a movie that would later be nominated for 4 Razzies. The Baca Boys quickly took an interest in learning more about Hot Carl, uncharacteristically interviewing me after victories, but I continued to keep my identity secret, mostly in fear that my bosses would find out, but also in case I eventually embarrassed myself. Eric and Nick were even taking bets from listeners on whether I was black or white. I'd usually perform the roll call from my dorm room, getting home just in time from class or work, but on some late Flintstones nights, I would have to lock myself in the script closet and hope no one walked by to hear me scream rhyming insults into an office phone. The Baca Boys started to have me freestyle to an instrumental of their choosing for extended amounts of time after my wins, forcing me to use an indoor voice to avoid suspicion from nearby coworkers. It truly was a pathetic sight, as the phone's cord would travel from my desk right into a closed closet, like I was dialing 911 and hiding from home invaders, or a teenage girl talking to a boy her parents forbade her from seeing. I was lucky my competition would never see my hiding place. Because you ain't the hottest, you should just come out the closet. Maybe the easiest and most perfectly homophobic battle knockout ever. I had tied the all-time record for most perfect wins in a row as I entered my 3rd week of victories. The Baca Boys invited me into the studio to compete until I was dethroned, an invitation that was rarely handed out, but also an obvious roadblock in keeping my identity secret. I contemplated sending in an actor to announce that I was terminally ill and could only rap over the phone from the hospital. I even visited a local costume shop to browse masks, but realized I would probably never win again if muffled by the latex face of Richard Nixon. I knew that no matter how hard I tried to avoid it, my anonymity was up. I would also have to start perfectly timing my Flintstones job so I could avoid traffic and make it to the studio, which sounded like a Mario Kart level of stress I wasn't thrilled to face. But when Monday came along, I finally stepped foot into the radio station I had basically taken hostage for weeks, and the studio exploded in surprise. The Baca Boys tried their hardest to explain my physical appearance. He's just a huge dork. But they couldn't stop laughing at me, and their own shock. I wore a bright Hawaiian shirt and sported the thick black-rimmed eyeglass style I still wear today, looking more like a member of Real Big Fish's horn section than the vicious battler they expected. Even corporate executives from the station came out of their offices to get a look at the rapper who had redefined the roll call for almost a month, but looked like he'd also do your taxes. I'd be lying if I said I didn't know my ultra-whiteness was a major element of my appeal. That's something I knew even during Extra Large. There had been white rappers before me, some of whom I openly idolized, like MC Search, the Beastie Boys, and Everlast, and Eminem was slowly gaining momentum during my breakout, but I still knew I was different from everyone else. I rapped only about what I knew, which for me was a suburban, pop culture-riddled life that, although familiar to most of the white fans flocking to hip-hop, had not yet been represented in the genre. Where 95% of rappers were talking about guns or jewelry, I was referencing the girls in my high school who got nose jobs, or spitting stupid lines like, "I'm too obnoxious to be called conscious, I drive a rape van like the white B.A. Baracus." On the roll call, and throughout the years I was actively pursuing a career in hip-hop, I regularly heard the phrase, "a white rapper who acts white," which is coded in racism, and beyond that, just dumb. I grew up loving rappers like Biz Markie, Dougie Fresh, and the Fat Boys, guys who had fun and didn't care about acting tough, and I wanted to bring that back. I called myself the Jewish Jay-Z, sampled Hall & Oates, and name-checked Dave Eggers. I wasn't making a racial statement, I was being honest. It's really all I could be. I was happy the listeners were appreciating the perspective. The roll call just got easier from that point on. I was experiencing an unstoppable stretch, racking up wins from inside the studio and trying my hardest to create entertaining radio. I brought in pinatas for the DJs to break if I won, and when they did, porn magazines came flying out. For one victory, I brought along USC sorority girls to boo after my opponent's lyrics and applaud after mine. I concocted ridiculous similes like, "So here's your warning, at least half of y'all been told, I'm just like little Bow Wow, but white, Jewish, and old. And you can't get at me, you ain't getting raw, cause you're uneven like Wilson Phillips on a seesaw." I still didn't see Hot Carl as a long-term endeavor, but if this hobby was to play out publicly, I wanted to have fun with it.